she said, Jen, what did you discover upon making this film? And like without a beat, I said, thank you so much. I discovered my voice and I have all of you to thank for that.
I'm Sally Christensen, the founder and CEO of Argent, a women's workwear brand. And this is Work Friends, a podcast for those who take their work, but not always themselves, seriously.
Work Friends.
Today on Work Friends, I am joined by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. Jennifer is an award-winning filmmaker, advocate, and the first partner of California. A Stanford MBA graduate, Jennifer's early career focused on work in front of the camera as an actor. That was until she no longer liked what she saw. Discouraged by the way women were represented in film and TV, Jennifer took matters into her own hands. In 2011, she debuted Miss Representation, her widely acclaimed documentary film that investigated the media's inaccurate portrayals of women, which have led to their underrepresentation in positions of power. A staunch advocate for women and girls, Jennifer has built a body of work through her company, The Representation Project, that examines societal and cultural norms that threaten women, as well as those fighting for a better way forward. She's here today as her newest film debuts, Miss Representation, Rise Up. The film explores the dangerous relationship between women and social media. I'm so honored to talk to her about her career, her new film, and so much more. Now on Work Friends, Jennifer Siebel Newsom. Hi, Jen.
Hi.
I'm so happy to see you and to have you on Work Friends, but I've also gotten to see you three times this week. So this week has been the best.
Okay, this is so fun.
So I was at your screening for Miss Representation Rise Up this past weekend.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And then you joined us on set for a very special project around our 10th anniversary yesterday, which I can't wait to share.
So fun.
So a lot more to come. But I'm excited to just dig into your story, your body of work. I mean, your career is so magical. I feel like you've really poured like yourself into it. But before we get into it, yes. I want to start with your biggest oh no moment this week. And you've had a busy week, so I feel like you have one. What's gone?
Oh no, was when I was talking to my husband at 11:45 p.m. New York Times, knowing I had to get up at 6 a.m. And I was like, oh no! He's like, go to bed. That was my biggest oh no. I'm so bad at sleep. I really stay up too late.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Same every night. When you start doing the calculation, though, of like, oh, I'm only getting 6 hours.
It's
like,
brutal.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Marin County, California. What stands out about that environment as far as growing up there and coming of age and what made it unique?
Mm. So growing up in Marin was pretty idyllic. You know, we had Phoenix Lake nearby and tons of hiking and nature and... it's just a beautiful environment. The temperature's really lovely. It's special. Moms had the privilege, many moms at the time when I grew up there had the privilege of not working outside of the home and of primarily being caregivers. And that's interesting. That shifted, but it's still a small, kind of idyllic, a little bit conservative community. When I think about my childhood, though, I think about Montana. And I think about when I was 4-ish years old, my dad bought a conservation easement, an old ranch in Montana that he turned into both a farm and conservation easement. And I spent so much time barefoot, bareback, on a little white Shetland pony named Sugar, and later a taller pony named Kid Stuff, with my best friend who grew up on the dairy farm next door, or my other girlfriend, Sarah Fox, who grew up, and we would like make little bologna and white bread sandwiches, and Lord knows, Mountain Dew maybe, and would put these little bags together in our bathing suits, literally barefoot again, sometimes with a halter, not even a bridle, and ride our horses out to some little riverbed and have a picnic and hang out and then swim with the ponies and then gallop home and get in trouble because we weren't wearing helmets. We were bareback and without any footwear. But I think about that. I think about rescuing birds that flew into the windows uh-huh. of my parents' home. I think about like all the little mice I used to befriend and like make my own. You know, I think about getting my driver's license at 16 and driving into Missoula and pretending that I was 18 and I could adopt the dog and the rabbit and being sent back there when my parents saw me walk in the house with a new dog and a rabbit and looked at me and were like, what were you thinking? So I just think about just freedom and the outdoors and nature and animals, and it really was a sanctuary and healing place.
I didn't know we shared this. I grew up on a farm in South Carolina.
Yes.
And we had horses, and I would ride bareback at, I mean, unsafe speeds with nothing right. else except a mane to hold on to.
Oh my gosh.
And right. it was so dangerous, but like so just, it was like everything. It was magical.
Yes.
And those are like my vivid memories are all with animals. So everything you just described, we had this yes. big picture window that the yes. birds would fly into.
Yes.
You'd go out and you'd put them in a shoebox.
Yes.
These
oh
are
my
things
gosh.
I think
or
about
try to
my
resuscitate
kids.
Them.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And sometimes they would fly off. You'd like
yes.
leave them out and they'd
yes.
fly off. I love this.
Oh my
so
goodness.
Much.
Yes. Wait, that's really special.
I'm curious to hear about what work looked like for you. If there were any early examples that made an impression on you, you know, who was that coming from?
So my dad, we lived in this riverbed area with lots of stones, in not just in the creek bed, but in the arena where we were trying to ride horses. And my dad would pay me like $5 a bucket. It may have been $1 bucket to like fill these buckets up with really heavy stones so that we could actually ride the horses in the corral or the arena. Mucking horse stalls was another job that I had. And then when I was in college, I did the typical waitress, hostess job at this restaurant bar that a friend had started. And then later I worked in retail for Betsy Johnson. I learned early on that the woman that ran the store, she only paid for anything in cash. So I really learned a little bit about the value of the dollar from her, because, you know, when you work in retail, you kind of want to wear the clothes. But if you don't have a credit card, you have to like look at your bank and go, can I justify spending this on this? So those were early jobs. And then, you know, after college, I worked for Conservation International in Africa and Latin America in DC.
What were you thinking about in terms of career, or were you? I had a very similar, like, I just wanted to work.
Yes.
All I wanted to do
yeah.
was work. And I think it was more common that moms were like at home, like all my friend
yes.
group, all moms were not working. Granted,
right.
being a mom is the hardest job,
yes.
but I think that's shifted so much. I think for me growing up, I didn't really see what I could be exactly, and that was
right.
one of the reasons I wanted to start Argent.
Yes.
Not to say that, I mean, it was just the Southeast and it was, you know, it felt a little bit more limiting, but I'm curious if there was like any career North Star that you saw in your childhood?
No, it's a great, great question. My father was in finance. He was in wealth management, and he was the breadwinner and the patriarch. And my mom had started, she was a spokesperson, she was a model, she was a stewardess, she was an interior designer. She had all these jobs.
Oh, wow.
But when we were born, my dad asked her to stay home with us. And she obliged, and she still volunteered. She started Tech at Home, and she created the Children's Bay Area Discovery Museum when we were little, which is like a wonderful children's museum in California. However, I noted sort of the power inequity, the power dynamics in the household, with my mom having to basically run circles around my dad and really care for not just the home, but ask permission to acquire things, what have you. In observing mm-hmm. the power dynamic at home and seeing how mom held so much but didn't have the same value necessarily, mm-hmm. even in the external world. I mean, everybody loved my mom, but everything, Ken Siebel, you know, they're just... We live in a patriarchal society.
Totally.
And my mom is very creative and special, but I did not want to be a stay-at-home mother because of it. And I just, you know, I had too many interests, too many passions, and I wasn't even thinking about kids. Like, I actually thought if I didn't meet my spouse, my now husband, that I was going to adopt kids later because I love children and I love animals, and but I was so passionate about life that I never was a girl thinking about my wedding and that whole thing. I just think career-wise, my career sort of found me, mm-hmm. And I think I tried different things on and explored. When I was 14, I wanted to go work for CI in Costa Rica. So a girlfriend and I went and worked for Conservation International in Costa Rica one summer. And that was the beginning of really my commitment to climate and environment, in particular conservation, and the beginning of my love and affiliation with Conservation International.
And was this during college or was this before?
Yes. So I'd done some work for them in college, and this was after college. I worked for them in Costa Rica when I was 14. I spent a summer there. And then during college, I spent some time with them in Botswana. And then after college, During college, I also spent a different summer studying wildlife management in East Africa and Kenya. I was studying the management of the culling of elephants to maintain carrying capacity. It was like fascinating. But then I ended up going back and working for Conservation International after college. I lived and worked in DC, Botswana, South Africa, Namibia, and then spent time in Peru and Ecuador.
This is my mom's dream career for me. She loves everything you just talked about. But you also grew up, what we didn't touch on, in a family of girls too,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
A house full of girls. And yes. I imagine that may have informed how your parents raised you as well, because it's how many sisters?
So we're
five.
My mom birthed five girls.
Yes.
Stacy, me, Brooke, Melissa, Jessica. Stacy died before Melissa and Jessica were born in an accident, tragic accident, right? She was eight. It was a few days before my seventh birthday on a family vacation in Hawaii. And that totally shook our house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, transformed everything. My dad, in some ways, raised us like tomboys or boys. Mm-hmm. But my mom also pushed the arts. And growing up, there was a focus on appearance and perception as reality, which I think I've always combated, which is perhaps why I got into entertainment and wanted to ultimately pursue, you know, a career in film.
Yeah, I mean, you're such a champion of women and girls. That's like, for me, how I know you, and a storyteller of their experiences in a really nuanced way. It feels like, and I'm going to ask a question, but I feel like you've already kind of answered it, but was it a role that you naturally stepped into early in life?
That's a great question. So after Stacy died, I spent a lot of time reading books and healing in nature. And we lived in Montana for a year. Shortly after Stacy died, I went to school there and we were pretty isolated. My dad was working remotely. We had the most amazing au pair, who's like family to us now, come and live with us from the UK. And I rode my horse to the bus that I then took to the public school. In the wintertime, my dad would cross-country ski out to the bus stop to meet us, and then we'd all go back together. It was really magical, transformative, and healing. And I think that in combination with I just immersed myself in Laura Ingalls Wilder and Nancy Drew and whatever I could get my hands on. And I think that's when my imagination and, you know, storytelling and books and film were escapism for me to kind of, in some ways dissociate from the pain and suffering that I'd experienced.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. I'm sorry.
No, but it colors everything.
Totally.
Like, we all have trauma. We all have pain and suffering. And if, you know, someone hasn't had it, they might have absorbed it through their epigenetics, or, you know, COVID was traumatic for so many people. So you don't escape the human experience of pain and suffering. It's just part of our human condition. And I think it's what we do with it that ultimately is so powerful.
It enhances our empathy, and I think it's the most powerful you know, emotion that we have. Education-wise, so we touched on work around it, but you went to Stanford where you studied Latin American studies and human biology. Then went into CI, and then a few years later, you pursued an MBA at Stanford. Is that the path? What promoted that move into continuing education?
So, I was passionate about sports growing up. I was recruited to play soccer at Stanford and basketball at Princeton. I ended up going to Stanford. I had a unfortunate situation with a soccer coach. I was sort of one of his last victims at Stanford, and he ended up also coaching me on the junior national soccer team, and he ended up getting fired for verbal abuse, but then something else happened. The next school he went to, which was worse because of what he'd already done to us, but it was very intimidating and uncomfortable reporting, and I didn't fully testify. I was a freshman, and fifth year seniors who were still around were the ones that were really supporting and encouraging me, and a senior who had experienced it as well. But you know, we were number one or number two in the nation at the time, Stanford women's soccer, and there was definitely a backlash because so many women on the team didn't know or hadn't had that experience themselves, because he was a good soccer coach. He just played mind games, was controlling, and he crossed the line sexually. Mm-hmm. And so that was in and of itself rough. And I think, and because of that, I was in human biology, because a lot of the girls on the soccer team were in human biology. And I thought to myself, I want to help people. And I've always wanted to help people. So I was pre-med, and I ended up working one summer in a children's hospital in Quito, Ecuador. And every time we'd go into surgery, and literally there'd be like a little slit of blood, I would pass out. I would literally faint and pass out. I'd end up on the ground. I'd end up in some on some couch or on the floor, and they'd be like, "You are the worst doctor." I'm like, "I'm not a doctor." And it's all in Spanish. I'm like, "I'm not, I'm studying, I'm trying. And it just happened three or four times. I was like, "Okay, I suck. I cannot be a doctor. I will not make it through med school." But also I was depressed. I was working in one of the rounds that I was on. We were in a pediatric ward with these children, these Colombian children, indigenous children who had been fed corn husks because they were so poor, and their malnutrition and the scabies and what it was doing to their bodies and their skin and their health. It was so painful. And then a kid came in, he'd been physically assaulted and abused. And I just it was a lot. And I can stomach a lot, but I was vulnerable at that young age. Yeah. And I realized that I was getting depressed. And I realized that was not a good career path for me. So then I went back into working for Conservation International. And I was overseas living and working in Southern Africa, in mostly in Botswana, and my boss at the time, her husband had been abusing her, and he'd stolen our car, and I was chased by a crocodile on foot and ultimately escaped. But that was another crazy experience. Just there were so many crazy things that happened that at the end of my year, and I'd applied to go to business school, and I got it. I was accepted to Stanford Business School. I was like, okay, I'm good to go back to the United States of America.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
It was always in the back of my mind to go back and work at Conservation International and try to be a leader there someday. And so kind of, going back to business school, I focused on that, global management and entrepreneurship. But the drama department was right next door. And I kept being like, what's going on over there? And I think it was a combination of, I really had always loved the arts. Mm-hmm. My dad had pushed me into sports. My mom had always kept the door open. I sang, I danced ballet, I did theater. So it was this sort of duality thing in my childhood of being like a strong, powerful athlete, but also being a dancer and entertainer of sorts. And I kept spending more time over there, and I did a play, and I, with this wonderful young actor, and who'd like been on Broadway. And then Sigourney Weaver came to the Stanford Business School, because she was friends with the professor, and taught a class. And I'd met Harrison Ford once before, because he'd been on the Board of Conservation International, and he'd done a really amazing job of speaking about the importance of conservation globally. And I saw the power that he had to really like impact our work, mm-hmm. and our fundraising and our organizational impact. And so between Harrison Ford and Sigourney Weaver, like demonstrating both intelligence and sophistication, but also impact in the real world, I thought to myself, okay, maybe I need to go into storytelling. And so I started taking classes at ACT and studying at night while I was in business school. And next thing you know, after business school, I was in Los Angeles.
Well, I do think that you're also touching on something that a lot of young professionals go through, which is, I'm really passionate about this thing. Do I pursue a career dedicated to a nonprofit or an organization that's entirely focused on that? Or is there a way that I can go about it a different way? And I remember having that conversation with my parents too. I think gender has always been my cause, like that I've really taken to. And like, I considered a stint with AmeriCorps, but it's like, I was sort of similar to you where I was like jumping in different things and just exploring different avenues, you know?
Yes.
And ultimately, obviously I graduated into starting Argent, but I do believe in that connection between like business success and impact.
Yes.
And
you're incredible at it.
Oh, thanks. But it's different, right? Like, it's like,
yes.
It's different than going into the nonprofit piece. I think all roles are important. But for me, like, it was sort of an active conversation for a long time, for years, you know?
So, what you're doing, I think, is what so many of us women lean into, which is more of like, it's a for-profit company, but with social impact. Some people call it B Corp, a conscious capitalist, but you're elevating others around you. You're making sure that individuals and entire communities are elevated with the success of your business. Like, I think that's essential.
Yes.
I think it's why we need more women in leadership, period, full stop.
Period. And that, well, now we're going to go into this because I'm dying to get into your career as a director, mm-hmm. as a producer. Before we talk about your work behind the scenes, I do want to talk about your move to Los Angeles that you just mentioned and what it was like, you know, in front of the camera.
Right.
Can you share how you started to break into the industry and what do you consider to be your most formative roles and projects from this chapter of your career?
Oh, good questions. So, first of all, my first agent told me to lie about my age and take my Stanford MBA off of my resume. Because I started at the ripe old age of 28. I didn't do either, but I was shocked and incredulous that an entire industry, the industry that communicates our cultural values and communicates cultural norms, that the industry did not see my education or my age as positive or a gift or something to mm-hmm. be proud of. And so that started, so that was, woo. I was creative, obviously. I wrote and produced some works. I knew how to raise money, and I clearly have a work ethic. And so I partnered with people, and we, you know, produced little films here and there. And, you know, and I guess I acted in most all of it. And then and I got TV series, you know, guest star, rolling. I mean, I was even like a guest star on Mad Men, which I'd hoped was recurring because I was the main female protagonist, old like college girlfriend. I walk in as a blonde and I come out as a brunette. And it was so crazy because I was like, I don't think that's in my contract, but I, you know, I'm so naive. I was like, okay. And then, but I was at the time I was a recurring on the NBC series Life, where I had to go like literally a day later or 2 days later back to life as a blonde. And so like they had to strip my hair and I went from like deep like brown hair. I was dating my now husband at the time and we go to San Francisco and people are like, Gavin has a, you know, new dark haired woman. And I was like, that's me. I mean, they were like, it was
just
me.
For the one day.
Yeah, yeah.
Just for the one
day. And she's older looking. I was like, yeah, probably the dark. Yeah, I was probably not wearing makeup. And I looked older because that's what happens when I darken my hair. And then we went back, then they stripped my hair. And it was like, I was, the first few episodes of life, I'm like, I think the first episode I'm a blonde. And then I'm like kind of orange. And then I'm kind of, or red. And then kind of orange. And then I'm kind of like, dirty blonde. I don't know. It was really funny to like, what's up with that girl's hair? But those were pretty formative. Well, because I got to work with incredible actors. I mean, life was, I worked with Damian Lewis, who's like exceptional.
Love. Oh.
He's so good.
Yeah.
I got to work a little bit with, well, anyway, it doesn't matter. I've worked with some lovely actors and.
Did it happen quickly though? Like, did you get opportunities?
I was in the industry, it was mostly indies that happened quickly, but I was typecast early on. Mm-hmm. I was the trophy wife, mm-hmm. the girlfriend, the victim. Yep. Good at crying because it's real. Like, yeah. I have a, you know, an imagination, I can go there. I mean, I also loved theater, but theater wasn't paying the bills.
Yep.
I liked commercials. I did some commercials even where they like aged me and put all the extra skin on you and, you know, they transform you. It was really fun. I loved it. But I also, I was antsy. I mean, I remember towards the end of life, I'd be on set at 11 a.m. and at 11 p.m. I still hadn't shot my scene or something because there were so many special effects in that second and whatever season we were in. And, you know, things just were taking longer. And I started to go like, this isn't a good use of my time, you know, because I'm a little bit too much of a busybody and my mind's constantly going. And I mean, I felt really proud of the work I did, but I wanted to do more and I felt stuck in the trailer and like I needed more. And also at the time, I was also with my now husband. I moved up to San Francisco with him. How scandalous. Mm-hmm. And we weren't married yet. And I did a play up there because I wanted to be a good actor and you learn so much doing theater. And I realized that there was so much like drama in politics and in the real world. And I started thinking about making misrepresentation. And I never thought that I would be a director. I liked being directed. I trusted other people to direct me. I liked acting. And I thought I could produce because I knew how to like project manage and raise money and pull people in and together. But I never thought I would direct. And as I was thinking about making misrepresentation, I kept asking fellow female directors that were more established and had made documentaries or even scripted features before, would you ever direct this for me? It's about how the media contributes to the underrepresentation of women in positions of power. And they're like, oh my God, that's so important. You have to make this film. I'm so sorry I cannot make it though, because nobody will hire me afterwards. Because they were so scared because they didn't have power in the industry. This was like before Oscar Moore, before Me Too, before Time's Up, right?
It's simultaneously not that long ago and a lifetime ago. It was just a different world. Like I'd say it was this is when I was just finishing college, 2006, 2007-ish. Is that right?
Yeah, and I started... Officially, we were in pre-production in 2008.
Yep.
Yeah, but it was 2007 before we were married where I was like asking people to make the film for me and I would produce it and raise the money and take care of everything. They just needed to direct it.
And everyone said no.
Yeah, and they were lovely about it. And I brought a gal in to help teach me how to direct and then another gal to help teach me how to produce or guide me and hold me. And they were so wonderful. I mean, but raising money was really hard. Every donor I went to, yeah. But literally, these are the messages I got in early 2008. This film has been made before. We've already achieved parity. Hillary Clinton ran for the presidency. You have Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We have bigger problems overseas. I even got from some women who were influential in the feminist circles, who is she to be making this film? But I ignored them all.
Yeah.
And I had the beautiful Regina Scully, who gave me seed funding, who's married to my godfather, who then, I love her so much, became the godmother of our daughter, Montana. And that set her on this insane, incredibly generous, just go, 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 go of funding documentary, female documentarians and all documentaries, social justice documentaries.
Can I just pause to say how amazing that woman is? I love her. I think you introduced us. She is a magical human being.
Yes.
And I don't think even as much, like I can tell the stories of a similar experience of the pushback you get when you do something focused on, like for me, it's a female specific product. I am a woman.
Yes.
Apparel doesn't do me any favors either. But in 2015, I remember having these conversations. So, I mean, this is 7 years later, but we're about to have our first female president. We've solved this already, mm-hmm. so very similar. Mm-hmm. It was because we were talking about it so much. I think people just assumed that like change had already happened.
Yeah.
But then there are these people that are standout like Regina that will raise their hand and will sign up for the project and are willing to take the quote risk.
Totally. She's so brave. And that, she was our seed funding. And then I just started, and I met, and you get that, we need those seed funders. And then, oh, she put money in, okay, I'll put money in. And it just becomes sort of this
game,
snowball effect. But I literally, though, I will say, Misrepresentation was funded by like 500 different donors. I'm not kidding.
Yep.
We had $250 donations, $1,000 donations, $5,000 donations, $100 donations, $25 donations. Literally, I would go to these house parties and I'd raise maybe $2,500 a night. And they were, you know, it was like so humbling. They'd be like, well, oh, that's really cool. I love it. But like, you always hold on, even though there's all this good and you have to make this film and it's so important, there's always people that you kind of hold on to the negative. So that's also something we women, like negativity bias, we have to pay attention to, like letting go of. But no, it was beautiful. It's like, then we got to this place and our first cut was not good. And the film, it just wasn't there. And one of my co-producers, I brought in Jessica Congdon to edit, and she became like one of my closest friends. We both gave birth to our daughters in the fall of 2009. And we were simultaneously breastfeeding and sitting in my dining room table editing almost 24/7. Like literally she would sleep, I don't know if she slept on the couch because it was like a two bedroom, but like she was there with me 24/7, I think. And baby here editing, and we made Misrepresentation, and we premiered at Sundance Film Festival to standing room only audiences, lines outside the door. Oprah Winfrey said, if this isn't an own documentary, I don't know what is. And boom.
Can I ask a question about this? Because I imagine it's similar with starting a company. I was so naive, and this was a new undertaking for you in a lot of different ways. Raising the money, stepping behind the camera for the first time, then taking it into production, into debuting it.
Yeah.
Did you feel that? Like, did you feel like there was a steep learning curve?
100% there's a steep learning curve, and 100% nobody pays you your value or what the film is worth. Like Misrepresentation, after 7 years, was still screening somewhere in the world every week. People watched the film 7 times. The film changed girls' and women's trajectory, their lives, their careers. And I don't remember what we were paid. But that's why we did our own semi-theatrical screenings and limited theatrical distribution, because we were like, we're not going to be held back by one broadcast network, and this film needs to be in every school. And we created curriculum, and we launched social action campaigns like Not Buying It and Ask Her More. But we had to keep putting new products of sorts out there and talking to new people and getting in front of different audiences. I was with the royal family in Abu Dhabi with this film. We were in Singapore, Afghanistan. We were in state departments and embassies all around the world. You know, I kept saying, hey, Netflix, what's our reach now? Because, you know, but of course nobody was giving us numbers at the time, but it was so fabulous. And I had a nonprofit and staff and a team I had to keep alive. And I had a newborn, and then I had another newborn. So that was the hardest part.
During the making, did you ever second guess it? Did you ever?
100%.
Yeah, that's
100% second guessed it. I mean, I had a guy come in, we'd hired him to do kind of like, it wasn't the graphics team that we had initially, but he was dating an associate producer, a woman I brought on board, and he started belittling me and talking down to me. And I'd mostly just worked with women. I'd started out working with a male editor and then found Jessica, who was just my partner in it. And Julie Costanza brought Jessica in. So it was just, you know, it's so great when you find your people. But this guy, I remember me giving him feedback on the phone about something, and he started laughing at me. And I fired him on the spot.
Oh, that's so great and rewarding.
But I was shaking because you're what the problem is. Like, you are not valuing me. He actually was trying to turn the lens on me in a way that was objectifying and demeaning and... It was so funny that he came in and reminded me of why I had to make the movie.
Totally. I mean, I think of so many early experiences in starting Argent and how long I let certain relationships go on, agencies that were led by men, all the mansplaining, all the investor conversations. You run into so much. You're just living within the patriarchy, and it's the wild, wild west. Like, I was coming out of a corporate structure and like the protection of HR, and then you're just on your own without those. You know,
yes,
that structure in place and that protection.
Yes, and you're a one-man show. You're doing everything.
Yes, yeah,
and you run yourself ragged,
and you're vulnerable, and it's new to you, and you oftentimes will give up your power because everyone's there to like take it, and I think you have to like step into your power as quickly and early on as you can, and have the thickest skin. Because you just come across like a lot of different types of personalities.
You do.
I have to tell you, I remember watching Misrepresentation. I know everyone has the story, but it, for me, I mean, was such an important film for me to see. I was living in California. I was working in tech, and I remember just like crying and watching it. And I think it was just so resonant for so many women.
Yeah.
And you know this, but it's like really informed a lot of the choices that so many of us have made.
Yeah.
And no one was telling that story. Like, no one's telling these stories, and no one was centering just how hard it is and how many obstacles there are. And I think that storytelling and that representation is so powerful, and to just have awareness of all the obstacles.
Yes.
And that it's imperative that we just keep going and moving through them and blasting through them.
And totally. And then we have each other's backs.
Totally.
And then we have women to go to who will be there for us. I formed a small sort of kitchen cabinet board out of the Representation Project, because we launched the Representation Project out of Sundance. And having them that were like, they were old, two of them were old friends of my mom's. One was Regina and another film investor. And that was sort of the beginning, right? And then I remember, though, the best thing was, I remember there was a woman I had to cut from the film. There may have been a few women we had to cut because we'd interviewed too many people. And there was a woman we had to cut. And I remember being really sad about it and embarrassed. And she was in the audience at Sundance. And she said, Jen, what did you discover upon making this film? And like without a beat, I said, thank you so much. I discovered my voice, and I have all of you to thank for that. And that sisterhood, that she was there for me, even though I'd cut her from my film, that's what's kept me going. And I imagine that's what keeps you going. And sometimes we have to remind people that, actually, I need help right now, because they don't know, right? sometimes things look like you have everything together from the outside. And I don't feel like we girls and women are always socialized to ask for help, or men for that matter. I mean, I think it's our country, people don't always know to ask for help. But that for me has, the best part of all of this has been the movement of women and girls. And then I turned the lens on boys and men and brought more boys and men into the conversation with the mask you live in.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you have been at the forefront of like all of these conversations that need to happen and these stories that need to be told. A question I have is around mentorship and sponsorship. And I think you've touched on it in doses, but what kind of mentorship or sponsorship did you find in your own career path?
I mean, Amy Ziering has been an incredible like mentor to me, and I love her. She's, you know, she brought me in on a couple documentaries that I'm not sure I deserve all of the credit she gave me, but you know, has
I'm
won Peabody's and nominated for an Oscar and won Emmys, and she's really been amazing. And obviously Regina came from PR, and so she's just bold and clear and like understands framing and packaging, and it's just so ballsy and courageous, and the ways that we girls aren't always socialized to be, we girls and women, and loyal to a T, like sister, deep. I would say, you know, just jumping to now, because there have been years where it's hard raising money for documentaries, just like for yours, and you're like, it's just $5,000 or, you know, yeah, or $50,000 or whatever, yeah, which to some people, I mean, it's a lot of money, but to donors, it's, you know. And I would say I got, you know, there are years where like people just didn't, I was a white woman, perceived privilege, she doesn't need our help, and so it was really hard for a while. But we just kept knocking on doors and making important, we thought, films and films that had an impact, and launching campaigns and education. And when we were at the premiere the other day, just, were you in that visual? Because you should have been. I don't know who was in it in the end, but it was like EPs and protagonists in the film and the film team, and it was like this array of 30 some women. I don't even know if there was a man in there, and I love men, but it was all of the support. And you know, these women, they've hosted me at Sundance where I could go talk to donors, and they had me come speak at this thing, and they came to California because I was doing this thing here, and they're just, the sisterhood is so powerful right now.
You're surrounded by some of my favorite people too, though. I don't know your entire network, but your team's amazing. I feel like it's a culture of optimism. Yeah. I think that you've really moved into the nuance of gender equity. I think involving men is so imperative, and I think you've done that so well. And so I just think that you've really pushed us past the, you know, the generation before us, which was that scarcity mindset, and intentionally a scarcity mindset. And I think you've really been at the forefront of just pushing things forward. And I think that starts with you, and like there's optimism, I think, and there's no room for negativity.
No.
And that's what stand out, because I think that it can creep up in certain conversations that I hear, and I'm like, no, it's all boats rise with the tide. Like there's really no room for it.
There's room for all of us. And so you exude that, you exhibit that. You're such the queen of like being a platform. That's what we're creating in different ways. I think we're all trying to create platforms to elevate women, elevate the feminine, support each other, connect. I mean, I love when I have so many, not kidding, because I love women so much, and I have so many friends who are now best friends.
Yes.
And I'm like, I'm sorry I can't join you, but you two love each other and like keep me posted. And it's just like so gorgeous.
Send me pictures. I'm the same. God. I feel the exact same. Your success is my success.
Yes.
And I think that's what's so exciting about now is I think girls have learned that. Like I think they are learning that. They're seeing that. I think they're acting differently.
Yeah.
Misrepresentation was widely revered, as we've discussed, when it debuted. And 15 years later, Misrepresentation Rise Up focuses on social media and the harm it can cause to women everywhere, from teenage girls to political candidates like Allie Phillips, who ran for a seat in the House of Representatives in Tennessee, or talks about the violent attacks targeting Nancy Pelosi and her husband. When and why did you decide to revisit the film?
It's a good question. I knew that we were going to have to make Misrepresentation 2.0. I didn't know what I was going to call it. With the advent of social media, around 2011, you started to see the like and share buttons take effect and a dip in girls' mental health. 1 in 3 seriously considering suicide, 53% of girls persistently feeling sad and hopeless. And then entered deepfake technology, 99% of deepfakes targeting women and girls, 96% being non-consensual pornography. And we started to see a downturn in women aspiring towards public leadership. And so that, really came into effect with the 2016 election. And then with sort of the fall post the Me Too and Time's Up movements. And we're seeing the misogyny and racism and bigotry and othering on steroids, again, because of tech-facilitated gender-based violence that has been weaponized to harm girls and women's mental health, safety, and power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I simultaneously remain optimistic because I do think we've made a ton of progress.
Yes.
And also so frustrated, I think.
Yeah.
But I like, our goal is to continue reinforcing the importance of, like, having
yes.
women in leadership roles at the
yes.
table, equally represented, we have to have access to equal opportunities, because it informs the technology, it informs, like, the safeguards that are built into it, it informs the AI and, like, how it's being built,
right?
You know, and so this is a conversation that, like, is endless, because
yeah, well, we don't have enough women
period
running AI companies. We don't have enough women
running any companies, to be honest.
And no, we don't.
Yes.
Of course. But given
yes.
the dangers and the potential downside of AI, obviously there's so many upsides potentially to AI if managed correctly, but it's really about the guardrails. You can have innovation, but you need proper guardrails. And look, we never instituted guardrails for social media, and look what we have, children taking their own lives. And it's not just impacting our girls and women, it impacts our boys and men.
Totally.
And so that's why, this work is so important. It's why we want to support, and you're doing it yourself, we want to support women in the private sector. We want to make sure that there are more female founders and female funders, and part of female founders is getting more money into the pockets of female founders, right? And ensuring that female funders have access to opportunity to invest in the marketplace. We want more women in politics, not just in leadership, but funding leadership in politics. And women historically have been the largest philanthropists, but it comes a day and an age where a woman shouldn't have to ask her spouse if she can contribute to something, donate to something, invest in something. Like, really empowering women financially, not just with financial literacy, but with the value of their investment and gathering their sisters to also invest in, again, mm-hmm. whether it's the marketplace, politics, or philanthropy. Like, if we can do that, we will achieve, I believe, the democracy that so many of us are envisioning and that our country purports to be. But right now, the reason I think our film Misrepresentation Rise Up is so important, and you and I were just talking about AI, is because it is such a threat, not just to women's health and well-being and safety and power, but to a thriving democracy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can you speak briefly about how your role as the first partner and a filmmaker complements each other? Does one, like, ever conflict with the other, and how have you navigated the tension?
Well, so there's a separation of church and state, right? When Maria Shriver was first lady, she was at NBC as a journalist, and she had to quit her career in journalism. I think Dr. Jill Biden at the federal level is one of the few that at that level that continued working while being in that office. I've had to continue working because it's my passion, my love, it's my creativity. It's good for my well-being to be a creative, but also because I'm a breadwinner, if not the breadwinner, a co-breadwinner in our household. You know, we have four kids, and so I've had to keep those separate because we don't pay our first partners. We don't pay our first ladies. We never have. One day, hopefully we will.
That's a whole other conversation because I've watched that time and time again, and it is a full-time job.
It is.
And then some.
When you asked me about first partner, you know, my work has always been to center and support women and give kids the best start in life and kind of rebuild community at the same time. I gave myself the title first partner because I wanted to signal to Californians that I was going to be a partner to them, to women and families in particular. And I secretly hoped, and I still hope, that there'll be a female governor someday. I was rooting on, in particular, all of the spouses of the gubernatorial candidates because they're all exceptional women, and I wanted to be able to pass things off to and share them with them so that to make their transition into the governorship smoother, because I didn't receive any support or anything. We had to start over from scratch because we didn't have a first lady's office. And part of that was because the former first lady was really a senior advisor to her spouse. But all that being said, as first partner, I've been focused on women's wealth, health and safety, and children's well-being. And then we just recently launched a campaign called California Love, California Strong, which intersects with some of the work I've done on the Gov's Advisory Council on Physical Fitness and Mental Well-being. So a focus on self-care, but also on California Volunteers, which is all about service. So it's a campaign that's reinvigorating community in California and giving people best practices and tools around self-care, service, and social connection so that we can really, you know, not just revive our communities, but thrive as Californians. And then one last parallel is I launched the California's Partners Project alongside the First Partners Office in partnership with my friend Olivia Morgan to basically do research and storytelling around California for All Women and California for All Kids. And I say that because we've done a lot in the tech realm. So what's interesting is like we've really focused on, at the California Partners Project, toolkits and best practices for parents to really support their children, themselves, and their families' best practices around healthy tech use. And simultaneously, I was separately making a movie on tech-facilitated gender-based violence. So they were separate, but they complement. That's the word I was looking for.
So complementary.
Everything separate, but complements.
I feel like your job uniquely positions you to be so effective as first partner. You know, it's such a gift, and I feel like the state of California, but beyond the state of California, is benefiting from that.
Yes.
And from you stepping into both of those roles simultaneously. It's the same as like when a different kind of example, but when you become a mom, I think you become, or a parent, you become a more effective leader because you just learn from that experience. So I think that,
oh my God, my husband loves working with women, in particular moms. Yes. He's like, give a woman a busy working woman something to like give her a leadership opportunity and she will like really impress you.
Totally.
Because she's got deadlines and she's got to get home to dinner and pick up the kids from you know, sports and what have you.
And empathy and like a lived experience, it's so applicable. And so it's like you're going to make them, you're going to be a more effective leader because you're setting the example and you're setting your team up most likely for the
and
same.
And perspectives. One of the things I'm most proud of is, and I really credit the partnership with our first chief of staff, Anne O'Leary, who the governor's first chief of staff. She really supported me and embraced me and brought me into rooms where we launched a whole parents agenda. And yes, we were parents of young children. And I think that image at my husband's first inauguration where Dutch straddled up onto the stage with him and crawled into his arms, I think that really made it clear you have like parents in the governor's office. But that it took another woman supporting me because those are my values.
Yes.
And my husband's like kind of a policy wonk, so he already knew all the early childcare values. Mm-hmm.
you know, universal pre-K and universal meals. And like he leans into that, but it really anchored, I would say, the administration. And, you know, so many women that were with us to the end or near the end, because they had to often leave because of child issues with children at home, family problems, etc. So many of the women, though, that we worked with, they always said, Jennifer, thank you so much. Or they call me first partner, so formal. But like, thank you so much for shining a light on our lives outside of work. And that's what I did, I think, with Fair Play too.
Yes.
Is reminding people that we all have lives outside of work that need to be cared for, and we need to care for ourselves. And if we don't care for ourselves and we're not caring for those in our life outside of work, like, we can't all show up and be the best at work, right? And that it really requires men to lean in more care at home, and men to also institutionalize care in the workplace.
We've touched on this throughout our conversation, but your resume is filled with work that aims to better the futures of women everywhere and ideally create a world where they can lead. So looking forward, what's inspiring your work? What stories are you still excited to dig into? And how do you determine what makes an excellent story to tell?
Ooh, those are great questions. I want to turn the lens back on boys and young men with the Mask You Live In 2.0. I have two boys. I see what the manosphere has done, the questions that it's probed in my 14-year-old son's mind. And he's, you know, looking for like role models outside of his own father and his own grandfather, and trying things on. And I really want to understand that and support him to be, you know, the beautiful human being that I know him to be. Those teenage years are a lot, though, and I'm just like really excited to dive deep into masculinities. I also have a 10-year-old who loves sports, and sports has its own mm-hmm. culture that, you know, is I mean, there are some incredible men in sports right now who are real leaders. But I want to make sure that he's sort of supported with the right, with like the healthiest role models as well. You know, climate is super important to me. That's where I started this work and found my a backdoor into supporting women in starting sustainable enterprises and micro enterprises and ecotourism and that whole work. So climate back into women as sort of holding their families, their communities, and now our economy. I will continue that work. But I'm really focused. We have 6 more months in the administration to really institutionalize our values. And so I'm focused on closing the year out with these roadmaps that I can hand to the next first spouse, first partner, hopefully. And I'm also trying to just make sure we make a dent in terms of women's wealth, closing the women's wealth gap, and really addressing some of the health disparities, which we've made some progress on, and the safety issues. And then again, like, I want California not just to be the state where California women can start careers, raise their families, and, you know, be successful. I want California to be the state where families want to really nest and raise their children. And because I just think it's, I mean, I'm biased, but I love California so much, and it is a microcosm of our country. We have extreme wealth and we have extreme poverty. We are the most diverse state. We inherited a bunch of, you know, affordability issues. But I'm just excited to kind of leave California in the best place that we can leave it.
I'd love to close this out by asking two pieces of advice.
Yes.
What advice would you give to storytellers who want to shift the paradigm of not only how women are represented, but how they can hold power?
My advice to storytellers who want to shift this paradigm is to lean into stories around women who have that duality of strength and vulnerability.
Love. And what have you learned about how we can all be better consumers of film, of social media, etc., today to uplift and advance women? And what power do we as consumers hold?
Oh my goodness, we consumers have so much power. I mean, it's why we launched the Not Buying It campaign, which also connected to Grab Your Wallet. In a capitalist society, our consumer power is everything. So we have to support companies that value women. We have to consume media that values women. We have to speak out and stop supporting in any form or fashion companies that allow for sexism, misogyny, racism, transphobia, you name it. Every day we make choices. And I stay away from reality TV. I've never been a fan. I've always found it to fall prey to tropes and stereotypes that are limiting. If there's a reality TV that really uplifts and empowers women, go for it, you know? I just think we want to champion female storytellers and stories with female protagonists. And you know what? I'm really excited because there are so many talented women out there that are writing stories, directing stories, producing stories. Their films need distribution. You know, people just need to use their power as consumers and citizens and write to the tables of power, write to leadership, write to the tech titans and say, I find it curious that you have, you know, no women on your board, or you have a minority of women on your board, or you only have 1% of women on your board. Like, I find it curious. You would make better products. Since women are 83 to 86% of consumers, you would make better products if you had more women in leadership, if you had more women in the C-suite, if you had more empathy, if you hired more men with empathy who were fathers, who actually cared about the future, not just about making a quick buck and being the richest person in the world. So I think it's just supporting people who speak truth to power, supporting people who are brave and courageous, who aren't afraid to tell those stories. We all have to support those individuals and those entrepreneurs who use their platform to uplift and elevate other women.
We've come to the end of our episode, which means it's time for my favorite segment. Oh, okay. Would you rather?
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay.
And this is very quick. Would you rather start work at the crack of dawn or burn the midnight oil?
I would rather start work at the crack of dawn.
Would you rather go back to school to learn a new skill or teach what you know to a class of newcomers?
Oh, I would... Equal.
Would you rather only answer emails with emojis or only answer calls on FaceTime?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. You know what? I should just say my first reaction, because I would rather go back to a class and learn than teach. And I would rather, so I'm being honest, because I'm tired and I just want to, I don't know, because I'm curious, even though I love teaching. And then I would rather... ask me the question again, and sorry. And then,
would you rather only answer emails with emojis or only answer calls on FaceTime?
Oh, emojis.
Oh, I thought FaceTime for you.
FaceTime people.
I feel like that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you rather make the wrong decision quickly or the right decision slowly?
Right decision slowly.
Would you rather be deep in the trenches of editing your last documentary or on a packed press schedule to spread the word about it?
Oh, deep in editing.
Uh-huh. Would you rather accidentally leave your mic unmuted or your camera on?
Neither.
Would you rather be a documentary filmmaker in the early aughts or in the present day?
Documentary filmmaker in the early aughts.
Mm-hmm. Same. It has been such an honor. I am such a fan, but I'm also so grateful to you. You've been such a champion of mine and just so supportive for the last 10 plus years.
Sally, I am so grateful to you. Thank you for loaning our esteemed experts and academics clothes. They looked so gorgeous in the documentary.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a partner there, but also just for being you. You have the biggest heart, and we are so blessed to partner with you and see you shine. And I just wish the best for you. And this has been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you for doing it. Congratulations on Misrepresentation Rise Up. Can you just quickly share where our listeners can watch it?
Folks can go to misrepresentationriseup.com. www.workfriends.org to the Resource Hub. They can agree to host a screening, sign up to attend a screening. They can nominate a youth leader. They can share their story. And we are on the film festival circuit, wrapping up at Tribeca, and then to DC and Arkansas, and to Bentonville Docks, and then I think to the Cape, and we will make rounds, and then we'll hopefully be in theaters in the fall.
We're going to put all the info in the show notes about where to watch. Thanks. And just where to find you. Thank you so much for everything that you do.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here.
This was so fun.
Thanks for listening to Work Friends, a podcast from Argent. Listen and follow on all podcast platforms. Subscribe to the Argent YouTube channel for more clips and bonus content. And follow us on Instagram @Argent for all the latest. And before you go, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment. It means so much to us. I'm Sally Christensen, and we'll see you next time.
Work Friends.
Work Friends is produced by Gina Marinelli with editing by Ryan Woldoff. Our theme music is by Karina DePiano and Melanie Naima. This episode was recorded at Podstream Studios in New York, New York.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Follow and listen to Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.